I'm Darius Larson. This is our second session on Genesis, and today's topic, Children of Eden, Loss of Innocence. And to set that up, I just want to read to you a few quotable quotes to get us in the mood. And this is from The City of God by St. Augustine. God created man upright, but man, being of his will, his own will, corrupted and justly condemned, begot corrupted and condemned children. For we are all in that one man, since we all were one man who fell into sin by the woman who was made from him before sin. From the bad use of free will, there originated the whole train of evil which conveys the human race from its deprived origin as from a corrupt roof. That's morning grace to you. And also, by the way, these are all taken from Talking About Genesis, a resource guide introduced by Bill Moyers, which is available at the bookstore for $5.95. The Lord's Prayer, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Rita Mae Brown, lead me not into temptation. I can find the way myself. Ecclesiastes 2:1. My son, if thou come to serve the Lord, prepare thy soul for temptation. Oscar Wilde, I can resist everything but temptation. James Thurber, we all have our flaws. Mine is being wicked. Aristotle, evils draw men together. Robinson Jeffers, as for me, I would rather be a worm in a wild apple than a son of man. Ooh. Franz Kafka, perhaps there is only one cardinal sin, impatience. Because of impatience, we were driven out of paradise. Because of impatience, we cannot return. Albert Hubbard, men are not punished for their sins, but by them. Alexander Pope, to err is human, to forgive divine. And finally, to sum it all up, Mae West. To err is human, but it feels divine. Oh, yes. Does it feel divine? What is temptation? Well, that's what we're kind of talking about here today. We haven't gotten a clue yet. What does temptation feel like? We won't go into what it is you're tempted about, unless you want to.
It's exciting.
It's uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. And comfortable?
They think uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable. Is it uncomfortable excitement? Mm.
It's a choice point. Yeah. Point of choice.
Should I or shouldn't I?
Is it enticing? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You kind of wonder what it might be like. There are some things I'm tempted to do, and there are some things I'm not tempted to do. I'm not tempted to climb Buckskin Mountain to its peak. But some people, they're very tempted to do that because they have the strength and the skill, they think, to do that. Temptations come not in our weakness, but in our strengths. They come at the point where Eve, I think, is the ultimate scapegoat in this story that we're going to get into. She is not the temptress, as culture has tried to put her. I would rather say she is the trailblazer. She is the one who sets the way to understand what it is that we are supposed to be about as far as being good. Temptations are incredibly luring. And as we will look at this, somehow just to say, don't do it. Makes you want to do it. Why is that? Any ideas? I mean, you can use, they say, reverse psychology on your children.
Yeah. Go
ahead. Don't talk in church, or don't sing in church.
Don't sing in church.
You know, I want you to keep quiet in church. Yeah. So, and they sing. Who would like to read the first seven verses of chapter 3 of Genesis? Who? Anybody?
You're not going to have Mandy do it?
No. In fact, it's not Mandy. It's somebody else who does it, but I don't have it set up properly. You can come at 1 o'clock and hear. I can't remember her name, but a wonderful black woman who just does a wonderful job. But I'll tempt you by to ask you to come back at 1. Will you read it? Okay.
Now the serpent was more crafty than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God say, 'You shall not eat from any tree in the garden?'" The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden. But God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch it, or you shall die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made loincloths for themselves."
Yesterday we left Adam and Eve naked, but not self-conscious of that nakedness. They were like, don't quote me here, my son and daughter at age 1 and 2, frolicking in our bathtub without clothes on, could care less about it. They would never do that. 13 and 15 today.
There's something happened between, though, that infancy and early adolescence. And many people have used this story as kind of a coming of age, as kind of a growing up of crossing the boundaries. Many people consider Genesis 3 as a boundary crossing of sexual awakening. The word knowledge in Hebrew can mean both moral knowledge or sexual knowledge. To know in the biblical sense, as I used to always say as a kid, to know in the biblical sense, thought I was kind of as dirty as I could get. It's only used just a few times in the Bible. It's used a lot more times in the moral sense. To know what is right, to know what is wrong, for what that's worth. It's a nice, you know, I used to think I was talking about the biblical sense when most of the time in the Bible they're not talking about that. Here, I think they're talking about both. To know the difference between good and evil. And they use it in the sense of understanding what it means to take of the fruit and eat it. How does Eve know what God has said here? Any of you know that? If you read the second creation account yesterday? Does Eve know this directly? No, God doesn't even say it to the woman. What it is that God says it to Adam, before the woman was even created.
So Adam told Eve.
So somehow Adam must have told Eve, and somebody in the first session said that Eve adds something to it. What does Eve add now? Is this kind of like how rumors grow? Especially what about temptations and good things?
You can't even touch it.
Touch it, right. In the original, you cannot eat of it. But now Eve says, you cannot touch or eat of it. And I would add, you can't even look at it. I mean, is that tempting? You know, and it, as soon as somebody says it's forbidden, sometimes you can't get that thing out of your head.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And where is it in the garden?
In the middle.
God even tells me where it is. You know, it's right there, in the middle of the room. Right there. Boy, it looks good. Oh, I'm hungry. My mouth is dry, and to bite into that apple would be better than this cup of coffee. If only God, and it looks much better than all these other things that are out here to eat. I mean, I don't know if I would have a mini camera here at the original garden, that if that tree would have looked any different than any of the other trees, and if that fruit would have been that much fruitier than any others. But somehow, because you aren't supposed to eat of it, it just pops out at you. It's just there. And wherever you go in the garden, you have to walk by it because it's right there, dab in the middle. You can't get away from it. We've talked in the first session about time here. We don't know if Adam and Eve had lived 20,000 years not that long, because they died at, what, age 200 and something, 400 and something, I can't remember. But we don't know how long they lived in the garden. And what I mentioned last, that the difference between Chronos time and Kairos time, and this is just speculation here, that Kairos time is present with God time, when you know that God is present. And in the garden here, God was present. So there, I would want to surmise that there's not such a thing as chronology here. There's not past, present, and future as much as just being with God time. And so here we are with God, and this tree is here. And what happens? You can't eat from it, but you can eat of any other tree but this one. And if you eat of it, what does it say will happen to you?
You will die.
And what does the serpent say? What will happen to you?
You'll be like God. You won't die.
Die? Yeah. That's just there to keep, to let you know that God has power over you. Mm-hmm. That God is in control. If you eat that, you will be in control. Have any of you raised adolescent children? Do they push the boundaries with you? Have you ever been an adolescent? Somehow, this story is a story about coming of age, about leaving innocence behind and telling mom and dad where to go. And mom and dad trying to either tell the son or daughter where to go, or trying to let go. And it's hard to do. Because as parents, we know what is right. But what is right is not to keep them at home and sheltered and locked up and protected, but to let them to experience life for themselves. Just say no to drugs. You will die! You know, can you see the parallel here? Don't do it. You could get pregnant. You could die of AIDS. I. It's pleasurable. You are immortal. Don't worry about this stuff. This is the first attempt to practice safe sex, probably. My dad used to tell me I can't cross the street because I'd be hit by a car. First day I crossed the street, I wasn't hit by a car. I knew my dad was a liar. Second day, I was lucky. My parents used to have a table. On the middle of the table, my mother would make chocolate chip cookies, and she would place them right there on the table. But we couldn't touch them. We could smell them. We couldn't eat them until after dinner. Some people in the first session said that was a bribe, you know, but it was a bribe, but I was tempted to eat. And how many of you have ever snitched a cookie or something that you weren't supposed to take? Yeah, I think that's a safe one we can all admit to, right? We have all been tempted by sweets, by food that we should not eat of. That apple sure does look good. What does Eve do? How does she process whether or not, as she looks at that apple, whether she should eat of it, whether she should touch it? By the way, when you say touch, you can break temptation down into little steps. Well, I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to talk with this person. Talking is nothing. I'm just going to spend a few hours with this person, and you know how the progression goes.
Just gonna lay in bed together.
Yeah. We just cuddled, Dad. Yeah, it just breaks down into stages. So Eve says, you know, touching it. I want to touch it. I want to see it. I want to touch it. She's at least processing. She's at least thinking about, this is good food, this is delight to the eyes. And what's wrong with being wise? Have you ever heard anybody say, don't be a wise blank, but is wisdom wrong? Wisdom comes from God. What's wrong with being wise? So Eve is pondering all this and thinking about all this, and she says, I'm going to eat of this apple.
I'm going to sample it.
I'm going to sample this apple.
But, but Adam is right there.
Mm-hmm. Watch it, yeah. And what does Adam do?
He takes it right after her.
Eve gives Adam the apple, and what does Adam do?
He eats it.
No processing there. No reflection there. Some people, some commentators, in fact, this one available in the bookstore, Wrestling with Angels, she does an analogy of this is how women in sexual intimacy need a lot of warmth and cuddling and foreplay, and men just want to... Bill Moyers has a great character. He says, Adam strikes me to be a sort of a divine simpleton. Eve is more interesting. She is proactive while he's passive. She's curious while he just accepts it all without comment. I sometimes find myself cheering Eve on in this story. Do you agree? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah.
I think it might be just an assumption on our part that Adam was right there, though.
We're not sure that is true. Adam could be there or not there. All we really know is that after Eve took a bite, Eve then brought or gave the apple to Adam.
Right, and that it wasn't until they both had eaten it together that they noticed they were both naked. It wasn't that Eve ate it and then noticed something.
Uh-huh.
It was that it had to happen together, and then they both noticed.
Yeah. There was definitely mutuality going on.
Right, and it wasn't just one person being able to do that.
On the other hand, he may have always wanted to find somebody that would take a bite first instead of drop dead. So she didn't. He figured, okay.
Gregory Bitts has a great poem. I think I could love you, but will you encourage it? You know, it's that sort of thing. You know, I'm not going to go first here. You know, it's like touch, and pretty soon all that game play. Yeah. Yes.
Another thing that I've always wondered is, did they have any concept at all of what this dying would be? At that point when God said you will die, leave this, did they even know what that is? How could they?
And if they knew, then they know something about knowledge.
Well, yeah.
Good point.
Yeah. That's the point of that.
The important thing about most of these stories, I think, is, especially this one, is this a prescriptive story that describes how we are to be, or how we are, or is it descriptive? It just describes the state we're in. And so I would rather think of it as descriptive, and then trying to answer those types of questions. And we don't have answers to a lot. We have wonderful speculations about them.
Yeah,
this is not prescriptive on how we live. This is descriptive on how life is. And I think that's at least helpful for me in many of these stories. Okay, they both now have eaten of this apple, and what happens?
Shame enters.
Just before shame,
they see her naked.
Their eyes are open. This is what this, and they don't die. Back to your comment, they don't die. The serpent's right. They don't die. Or is it that now they become aware that they will die? Before they were like animals, if this is true about animals, that there's no sense of self-consciousness, no sense of who they are, as some babies are that way too, I suppose. And all of a sudden there comes a point where you can see where you were, where you are, and where you're going. That's a form of consciousness. That's a form of knowledge. And that, how do I live my life now knowing that I am a finite being? I am not God who will live forever. I am not like these animals who don't even know that they will die. I am human. And I live in that kind of in-between spot. Their eyes were open and they, what? Back to whatever somebody said over here. They were knew they were naked.
They did die though. The death of innocence.
Yep. If you're a literalist, they did not die. If you want to plug in what type of death there was, there's all sorts of death going on here. Right. Once they were naked and not ashamed, now the death comes and they lose the loss of innocence. They are naked and they feel, or they know that they're naked. What do they do when they know that they're naked?
They sew clothes.
Yeah. They sew. Do you notice how all these pictures of Adam and Eve have little, not clothes, but little fig leaves. Yeah. Somehow, after awakening, crossing that boundary, which they cannot ever go back. Once you have that knowledge, if we want to keep the sexual metaphor going, once there's been a sexual awakening, there is a much more of an awareness of who you are and what your body's all about and what your body's capable of doing. And there is not only a self-awareness, but there's another awareness. And this is where we've had the early church and many people today have still been doing all sorts of things with this text to make people feel shameful of human sexuality. Yes?
here again, when I was reading this morning, I never thought of this before, but it came to me. How did they know what part they ought to cover? Why didn't they just
That comes with knowledge.
Well, it was probably the parts that each other touched of the other most often. When they yeah.
Who knows? Who knows?
Maybe they covered their whole selves. Yeah.
Well, but then it says a loincloth.
A loincloth, that's true. That's true.
Oh, it says an apron.
Why does God place that temptation in front of them? God obviously knew they weren't strong enough to resist forever.
How do you know? He just made...
Why would they say, okay, there is that, don't touch it. Don't touch it, you know, or you'll die. I mean, but he puts this glorious thing right in front of them. Yeah. And he obviously knows they're going to weaken and experiment.
And if God knew, did God put it there for that exact purpose?
That's possible.
Don't forget, if we're mixing first creation story and second creation story, the first creation story, there's a blessing about being fruitful and multiplying.
Right.
The second creation story, which this is an extension of, there's no talk of children at all. Somehow, how did kids get here? How did Adam and Eve discover their sexuality? How did they start conceiving? Somehow that had to be told in some sort of way. And why is it so bad? And I don't know if it is as bad as we like to put it. I think we read it through Augustinian and lots and First Timothy's lenses all too often, and we think it's that. In fact, the word sin can't be found here. The word sin comes in the next story, Cain and Abel. And we think that, you know, is the fall here or is the fall at the first murder? You know, people we play around with this text and we think that the fall came and this is all evil and bad and all these sorts of things, or is this really a way of growing up? That's what's fun about this story, is that you don't really know all that.
It seems to be inevitable to human nature that we tend to be best learning by personal experience as opposed to having heard it from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only way sometimes to learn is to do it yourself and then find out, oops, I guess I wasn't right next time.
Yep. And my son and daughter won't learn that way. Dream on. Right. What happens in verse 8? It's a great, the first part of that is just wonderful. They heard, not the voice, at least my translation, the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden at the time of the evening breeze. I mean, here, I'm going to use our old way, before the fall. God was with Adam and Eve, just kind of strolling around in the garden, walking around, smelling the roses, just enjoying it. And just Adam and Eve hear God coming. And what do?
Hide. Like disobedient children.
It's just like
disobedient. Have you ever done something you weren't supposed to do? I'll never forget the day that I bumped over a lamp at my house where my family, was in our family for many, many, many years. And I heard my mother say, "What was that?" And I moved so fast down the stairs into the basement, and I can still remember my posture. I just curled up like I was in the womb again, and I wanted to return to the Garden of Eden and say, don't let them find me, don't let them find me. And I knew that my mother was hurt because she didn't punish me. She came down and sat with me and cried with me. I almost wanted a beating. I think it hurt more knowing that it hurt her so much she didn't even lose her temper. I know what they must have felt like. And I think if you can think of your childhood memories, or hopefully they're all childhood. And if you ever wanted to hide from the wrath of someone, you at least perceive it to be wrath. And then what happens? God thinks this is kind of the first game ever, hide and seek. Mm-hmm. Where are you? What you doing? You know? And then what happens here? Adam says, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was
afraid.
Because I was
naked.
And I hid myself.
He's not afraid because he knows he's eaten the apple.
What was that?
Interesting that it's not stated he's afraid because he knows he's eaten up the fruit.
He doesn't want to tell God.
Yeah,
that's true.
I was naked, but all of a sudden the slip was afraid and naked. This isn't about hide and seek. Something went on here. Did you eat of the tree? Who told you you were naked? Something's going on here. What's wrong here, kids? And what happens next? First, you deny the reality of what you've done, and when you're caught with the evidence, you blame. And who does Adam blame?
Poor Eve.
The woman made me do it. Not only that, but who else does Adam
blame?
You gave this person to me. It's your fault. Do kids ever talk that way? I talk that way. It's not my fault.
We all do.
Yeah. You didn't pick up after me. I tripped over my clothes because you didn't pick up after me. Right. Adam blames God and Eve. Eve blames the serpent made me do it. This story, I think, is not as much about sexual awakening or right and wrong as it is about accepting responsibility for our actions. What if Adam would have said, and we don't know this, but what if Adam would have said, I did eat, and I take full responsibility. Might we still be in the garden today?
Something else would have happened.
Well, yeah, maybe for a day longer. Yeah, something else would have happened. We think of this in black and white terms of right and wrong, of good and bad. And it's really, I think, a story about learning to accept responsibility. It is a story about how kids grow up and now have to fend for themselves. Parents may kick them out, parents may want to keep them in their sheltered home, but sometimes, somehow, they have to move on. And then I hear they come back and back and back. That's another story. God, they were afraid. And the word afraid can mean, as some of us know, fear and awe. They were fearful of God and in awe of God. They now, with this self-consciousness, they know they are finite. They know that they will die. They know they are not like God. And even after eating of the tree of good and evil, they will never be like God. They won't be like the animals, but they won't be like God. They are human. And they're in awe of God, and they're very fearful of God. If we have time, and if we don't, I just want to put a footnote in here. you should take a look and spend some time thinking about, if this is all we knew about God, what would God look like? God is kind of this jealous, vengeful, punitive parent. You know, there's not this merciful, blessing God in this story for some reason. There's some hope in there. But anyway, integrity or the lack of integrity is what I think this story is all about. And when I think about that, I think Eve probably has more integrity than most of the other characters in this story. She's curious. She's inquisitive. She wants to know. She wants to grow. She wants to be something other than she is. She wants to evolve. And whenever you want that, you will cross boundaries. You will move into directions that fools dare not trot. And then what happens? What does God say to the woman? In verse, let's say, 16 here. I'm going to skip the serpent stuff. I might just skip it because I'm not sure who and what this serpent is. I might just say, the serpent is, it's a phallic symbol. But we really don't know much more about who and what this serpent is. We don't even know if Eve imagined this conversation with this animal, or this animal really walked and talked and had legs for at one time, you know, all these sorts of things. That's just pure speculation. We don't really know, and the serpent is not a major creature later in the Bible anyway. So I'm going to leave that the snake, except for it may have something to do with why, and I think it is it 90% of women have some sort of fear of snakes? And really, it's a lot more than men have.
Plus the men that chase the girls with snakes to make them afraid when they're little.
Well, that could be, but do any of you have any ideas about the serpent? Any of you want to share something? I just come up blank, and most of the commentators don't deal with it either, and so I don't have. Yes.
Well, the only idea that I have is that thinking about these Genesis stories, the creation, temptation, all this is mythology to explain, as you were saying earlier, descriptive mythology to explain why people are as they are and why this condition. And that in the ancient Near East, borrowing mythology traditions, so borrowing from the Ugaritic peoples or
yes.
the early Canaanite or whatever, so somehow serpent or dragon figure was prominent in that mythology and sort of walking, came over the other part of Hebrew mythology. It's the only explanation, but that still doesn't say a lot has changed.
That's true, and they were, this story was, in the Mesopotamia area, there were other stories similar to this, and they probably just borrowed the crafty serpent. And the word crafty and the word naked, there's some sort of, I can't understand, but there's some sort of interesting wordplay on those two, craftiness and nakedness, that I can't remember, but it's there. Anyway, moving on to 16, and God here starts saying to the woman, by the way, this is the first time I think that God speaks directly to the woman. Every other time it's been through Adam. Mm-hmm. What's that worth? What does to the woman, he says, I will greatly increase your what?
Pain.
In childbearing, in pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall what over you?
Rule
over you. What do you think that means? And how do you
what do you think?
Well, I know what it means. No, I'm afraid that there have been too many people who have abused this phrase. And more violence has been done to women because of this. Some people think it's just because of the mistranslation of the word helpmate earlier, but it's really about God told me I can rule over you, that I, man, is ruler over you, woman. What the word could be translated as, and what it means, I think, is protect. You, man, will protect you as rulers protect their people, whoever they are. The peasants!
So, that would be the only positive thing in the whole series here. Everything else is a negative outcome, not prescribed by God, but God says, this is the way it's going to be. It's going to hurt when you have kids, worse than it did before. That's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Your husband's going to rule over you in the first sense, abuse you. That's a bad thing. The ground's going to produce thistles. That's a bad thing. Why try to make that positive? I think it's not God giving permission to men, but God saying, because you live in a broken state, this is what's going to happen. Male abuse over women, along with all this other list of things. None of them are positive. Why try to make that one positive?
And I was there to think that one's positive. I don't think that to say that I'm going to protect you means I'm going to have control over you and I'm going to make sure you're safe and you're not going to get to do what you want to do because I'm going to choose what's right and we'll be safe and protect you.
Okay, let's move back about 3,000 years now when this was written. There's no such thing as birth control. Except for don't do it. The women's period of fertility period was basically you were either pregnant or nursing children during that period of time. Who would take care of and protect, rule over you so that you can still have life? This is not prescribing, but describing the reality of the situation there. And what I want to say is that if it's to protect during your childbearing years, at least, is the way it has to be. Otherwise, the woman is just nonsense. It's just you just. Enjoy and leave, enjoy and leave, enjoy and leave. And whether it is rule over, or as most translations say, what is it? I forgot it all of a sudden here.
Dominion.
Rule over, dominion over, or protect, you know, protect. I mean, it's...
You know, kind of to his point, though, and these kind of amazing things in these kind of stories is that, you know, that might have been one of the dynamics in the text when it was written and heard, and yet here we're in the 20th, almost 21st century, and our relationships are not, you know, foraging and fighting and tribal kind of existence. We are in a much more complex place. And so for us, this text can really say, I think, more along what he brings up, that the domination or control and protection of men to women is not initially what was intended in the garden, but it does very well describe what a lot of our experiences are.
Mm-hmm. And it has little, if any, place today because of the situation of how men and women in relationship are today.
In our culture.
Yeah. In our culture.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Excuse me. That's very good. I made a leap there. Right. Did you know that the number one stock people are saying that one should invest in today is Avon?
Because men are
going to
start getting
something. No, and Avon. My mother was an Avon lady. I remember sorting all these bags and sorting all these other sorts of things. It was her first job while she set pins in a bowling alley, similar to what they did here. It was her first job outside the home. It was her sense of liberation. I never thought of Avon as being
a company for women's liberation. But Avon is marketing now in China and other spots of the third world that women can finally, for the first time in their life, get out of their homes and spend 1 hour a week, you know, 10 hours a week, 40 hours a week, like my mother started to do. And so, you know, it all of a sudden it makes sense. I just, a little side light, yeah.
This isn't what we're talking about really, but could you tell me, in pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband? Meaning?
Sexuality, attraction.
That probably...
Even though you keep on having children, you're still going to want to be with your husband.
You will still want...
negative thing.
You're forget
Are you speaking
autobiographically? I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I don't know. Is it negative, or is that desire? You will have that urge to. You will have that sex drive, and that sex drive will yield children and pain. But you will still have that drive. Is one way to read that.
But I can't believe too many women who've had 12 children are looking forward to it. It gets to the point where it's sort of like, you probably never want to go to bed.
I know that, but it says desire, and desire means want.
Want.
But you know, that's a whole different thing than just being.
You know, wasn't that how they maintain their self-worth? Was by how many sons they had?
I'm jumping back to the first creation story, that what blessing is, what the word blessing means is to create future. To be blessed means that you have future. And by the way, jumping a little bit ahead here, after all of the problems of that they say about Adam, which we'll get to, what happens? What does in verse 20, the man does something. Here's this litany of all these negative things, all these terrible things that are now happening because of this one act. And what happens in verse 20?
He names her Eve because she's the mother of all living things.
This is where we get the name Eve. Before this, she was woman, the woman. Now she is Eve, which means life. The mother of all things. In the midst of all this pain, all this suffering, all this angst, all, whatever you want to call all this stuff, Adam perceives hope here. Adam sees blessing. We can have kids still. We will live on, not me, but through our children. All of a sudden, we understand this is the be fruitful and multiply passage of this creation story. And all of a sudden, oh, you are not just Eve. You are just not the woman, meaning a part of me. Oh, woman, you are Eve. You are the mother of all things. You are life itself. And the word that Adam uses for Eve is not made up of ish, which is the word for Adam, which is ground, which is dirt. All of a sudden, she does have a separate identity here.
And the mitochondria is tagged back through generation to generation to generation to woman.
The what?
Mitochondria, the power of the cells.
Oh.
I mean, when they traced it back to Eve, you know, when that Eve was found in Africa, it's the mitochondria, and it goes down through the women.
It does go down through the women. Huh. It'd be interesting to ask Ted Peters what he thinks about all that. The genes made me do it. I was predisposed to eat of this apple. It's not my fault, God.
I like the next verse.
Okay.
David Teedy, when I took my word and witness training, talked about God spending all night the night before making their clothes. so that they had clothes to wear when they left, so that they wouldn't be naked when they left the garden. So God was trying to take care of them as best as God could.
Yep, yep. It's very important that there is that element of grace there. That God does get, I think, a bad rap, and rightly so, for lots of the images here. But the one positive thing is that God makes clothes for them. And you know the word, what is the word here? What verse is that?
21.
No, it's not there. I can't remember where this is. I'm sorry, this is... I'll blame it on my computer. It's not me. It's the computer. It's gone. Anyway, the story here that let's get back a little bit to Adam, and what was Adam blessed with or cursed with or whatever you want to call it, and then we'll move.
And work.
Work. You know, yesterday I made this big deal about work was a part of paradise, mm-hmm. and how nice it was, and you know, this is our calling and all this. Yeah, that's true, but now
thorns and thistles.
There is something else about this work. If some people say that Adam or Eve were not cursed, but the ground was. Mm-hmm. And Adam comes from the earth, and now all of a sudden somebody said that they like to garden, so work is, you know, a gardening, that's not work. But now back once again 3,000 years ago, the agricultural society was just getting going and moving, and women's primary responsibility was childbearing, and men's primary responsibility was working in the garden. And this is garden creating, trying to create something out of the sand.
I don't know.
No?
No, in these ancient cultures, it was the women who did the work in the garden, the men hunted.
But not in the, but when they moved into the agricultural world, especially once again during the childbearing years, how could they do it?
Well, you saw them in the film yesterday, in the African one, where they were, where the babies were strapped on their backs and they were digging out there, yep. doing
and the
planting.
And the old ladies took care of the
earth.
Yeah.
Yep.
Fred, the good earth, she has the baby, goes back out and farms.
Yep. Yep. We will see. We'll see. Okay, the women do it all. The men just kind of. Marv Coleman. I'll put this on tape. Marv Coleman confessed to me, Missouri Senior Campus pastor in St. Cloud, that he and six men would go up hunting every fall. And they all brought their guns. And they went hunting, and they got to the cabin, and they left their guns in the car. They just needed time away to talk. And they couldn't tell anybody that. That's not men's stuff.
A Garrison Keillor story.
The what?
A Garrison Keillor story.
A Garrison Keillor story, yeah. Well, yeah, it probably is, yeah. And St. Cloud, Lake Wobegon, you know, same spot. So, who knows, you know? Yeah. Blame it on the men. Okay, we'll take the responsibility.
All right, I mean, I was here to the point you were making earlier, and I was looking for some parallelisms in the curses here. And I said nothing else was positive. You're right. The end of the cursing for Adam too is also that you shall eat. I mean, each curse does, if you want to interpret Eve saying, but you will be fruitful, you will be a source of blessing as one who bears children. Despite what happens to vocation and work to Adam, nonetheless, the bottom line is, you know, verse 18. Well, okay, 19, yeah. By sweat of your face, you shall eat bread, and the earth shall produce.
Mm-hmm.
So that's still a blessing. I mean, despite the fact that it's harder, nonetheless, God's word here is it's still going to work. We will still make it work together.
Yeah. A tape I'll be playing here, sung by Eve from Children of Eden, says that I still believe in second chances. That it still will work, and believe it or not, as we get through this, and any of you have read the Bible from beginning to end, it's, well, what should we try this time? Kids, What should we try this time? Why, you blew it again? Well, what should we try this time? This time. I mean, the amazing thing about God is God doesn't give up on us. I mean, there are some parents who really give up on their kids. I mean, especially if they do what they're doing here. You know, tomorrow we discover one kid kills the other kid. Why? That'd be a tough one for me. I can understand Noah. We're jumping way ahead here. He said, well, let's just wipe it all out and start over again. You know, but when, why did I pick Noah? But that's the next time. Verse 23 is they sent them forth. This is where, and this is in this wonderful book here by Naomi Rosenblatt, that she perceives Eve at this point not as the temptress, but as the trailblazer. They are sent forth, crossing the boundaries east of Eden. And then there is this, as parents always want to do, change the locks on the door. What does God do here to keep them out? Yeah, to guard their way, you know. Gives them help, but also lets them know that they are now responsible. And I'm amazed here that nowhere in this story does Adam and Eve apologize or Adam and Eve despair. Is this the fall of man? Or is it the beginning of the rise of humankind? Is this the beginning of what it means to be human? I think the fall comes tomorrow with Cain and Abel.
You know, that's an interesting way to relook at it. Instead of saying original sin here, here's bliss. And woman acts, and man follows, and then it's downhill ever since.
Yeah, really, really.
Instead of saying that, here's Adam, or at least as the word means, you know, inert dirt, mud, you know, kind of not active, lump of clay, and then Eve is very proactive, and she becomes the mother of all things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, God even saying, you know, I created all things, and now you're going to be the center of ongoing creation. So it's almost like, again, that I've been the parent, now you're the kids, now it's your future. You know, it's like a handing off of power in some ways. It's kind of like naughty, naughty.
Yes, yes, yes. Eli Wiesel says it this way. Rejected by God, Adam drew closer to Eve. Never were the two so united. Expelled from paradise, Adam and Eve did not give in to resignation. In the face of death, they decide to fight by giving life, by conferring a meaning on life. Like Adam, every one of us yearns to recapture some lost paradise. Every one of us bears the mark of some violated, stolen innocence. And then Naomi goes on to say that in many respects, I feel that Eve stands as a formidable role model for contemporary women. She is not content to blindly accept rules. When faced with the option, she relinquishes a world of safety and security for knowledge and experience. At some point in her life, every woman is an Eve, standing alone before the fruit of knowledge, carefully weighing its cost and benefits, and finally, deliberately making her choice. At the conclusion of Children of Eden, that musical that I spoke of yesterday, Eve comes back on stage, and we have just witnessed the garden, we have just witnessed Cain and Abel, and we've just witnessed Noah and the flood, the apocalypse. and Eve comes back with the rainbow, and she sings, and this is what I would have had up here for all of you. I only have two copies of the lyrics. If any of you want to look on with each other, it's about a 3-minute song. I just want you to hear it. It kind of sums up what I think we've been talking about today. And then if anybody wants to stay around longer, we can sure do that.
Like this brief day, my life is here.